You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
So I return once again to our living room. One more time. That's not true. We're going to return to the living room all the time. And in the living room, again, I remind you, our kids are begging, pleading, that as soon as church is over, we're going to go home, and we're going to sit down in that living room on our nice couch, cozy couch, with our cozy blankets. We're going to turn on the TV, and we're going to play Lord of the Rings, the extended version, from beginning to end. And there is a pleading, a begging, Dad, do this. And then I assure them, I promise you, I swear to you, I make a covenant, solemn covenant vow to you, that we will go home after church, we will sit on our couch, we will put on our cozy, woolish, I think it's fake wool, full woolish blankets. We will turn on the TV with the speakers. We will watch Lord of the Rings extended version from beginning to end. And then we go home, and my kids, as they rush into the house I move a little slowly on Sundays, get out of the car and kind of creep up the driveway and up the steps and into the living room, and I find already my kids who sprung into the house, that they've taken the TV, they've smashed it on the ground, they've broken it in half, they've set it on fire, they've torched the couch, the blankets, they have, this is the new thing, and I didn't quite complete the thought of what they're doing to the blankets, but they're doing something horrible to the blankets. And so the blankets are now on fire. The couch is really a big fire that's actually starting to burn the roof of the living room, so we can't even sit in the living room to watch this movie. The TV is now unusable. The speakers have been thrown down and dropped in the tub full of water, and just despite me. And so we find a house that is overrun with destruction, and yet I've made promises, right? I've made promises to them that this is how our afternoon is going to play itself out. Here's what our time together this afternoon is going to look like, how wonderful it's going to be, what you're going to have around you, the nature of the couch that I purchased that we could sit upon as a family as we enjoyed the glories of Tolkien made visible. And this is the joy of what we're going to have this afternoon. I've made promises, not just promises, but solemn oaths, covenant vows that this is what we're going to do. And my kids have destroyed the TV, the couch, the blankets, the living room, likely with that couch, the entire house, as the fire would spread very, very quickly, I'm sure, given the fabric it's made out of. And now we are confronted with a problem. And the question is the question of my righteousness. How can I be both good? How can I be both just and righteous? And one who keeps his good promises. How can I do both things? This is the question that's been raised by Paul in Romans 1, 16 and 17, that everything that comes after it, essentially everything that's going to come after it in the entirety of the book of Romans is about. It is straining to answer through argumentation that question. How can God both be just and the justifier of the ungodly? How can God both be good, a God who creates good things, who keeps good promises, who fills the world with his goodness and his beauty and his truth and his majesty, and a just God who does justice upon those who corrupt that good world? That's the bottom line question of the book of Romans. In other words, the question of Romans is not primarily or first of all a question about me or a question about you or a question about us. It's not first and foremost trying to solve a problem about your life or my life. It is asking predominantly, at its very most base foundation, it is trying to address a problem about God, a question about God. And chapter one has been all about the moment that I, to take the narrative, that I walk into the living room and I behold the TV on the ground burning, the couch burning, the blankets, whatever they did with the blankets, and the speakers in the tub that somehow been leveraged out of the bathroom and dragged out into the living room, with the speakers in it. And it is painting a picture of that room, and two, it's attempting to answer the question, what on earth is wrong here? In other words, it's doing something brilliantly insightful as it describes not just the nature of the world that we live in, but also describes how in the world did we get here? But one of the most important functions of your medical doctor is to be very, very careful not to simply address symptoms, but to address the problem. Do you understand? Like if I go into the doctor complaining of shooting pain in my right leg, if all he does is give me medicine to cause that shooting pain in my right leg to stop, it doesn't address the potential problems that are leading to that shooting problem in my right leg. He's not a very good doctor, correct? Like you don't want a doctor who just kind of puts a salve on the wound. You don't want a doctor who, if you're uncomfortable and nauseous because you have some form of cancer, just gives you medicine to take the nausea away. You want the doctor to address the core problem, where the nausea is coming from, where the shooting pain is coming from, why the wound won't heal. You want the doctor to address the real problem, not merely the perceived problem. And one of the most brilliant aspects of Romans chapter 1, the text we just read, 18 to 32, is that Paul is attempting not simply to describe the problem, not just to give us the symptoms, although we're going to get the symptoms in spades this week, but to describe the root of the issue. And so I want us to look at Romans 1. I want us to look at kind of the whole context of Romans 1 and to go back and to kind of illustrate for you from the text why the why or the roots of the issue are so that they are so dominant and so important for Paul. I want you to look with me at verse 28. So technically our verses for today are verses 28 to 32, but I want you to see how it begins in verse 28. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. That's verse 28. This is his restatement in a sentence of everything he said for the previous 10 verses. In other words, in this sentence is a summary of the argument that he's made beginning in verse 18 that's preceded up to verse 27. And so I want to trace that argument for us quickly, and then we're going to slow down as we get into verse 28. First, he began, you'll remember, with the assertion, and here, if you'll think of chapter 1, verses 18 to 32 as a tree, at the very root of the problem, he begins, one, with an assertion, and then he begins to trace that assertion through the roots of the tree. The assertion is this: everyone on earth knows who God is and knows what he's like. They know that he's glorious. They know that he is powerful. So maybe you're in this room and you're trying to decide about what to do with Christianity. Maybe you're trying to decide what to do with the particular claims about Jesus. Maybe you've even wrestled with atheism and whether or not there even is a God. Here's the bold claim of Scripture that's going to run counter to your intellect this morning. The Bible says that the question of whether or not God exists is not a real question that you're asking. It would assert that you know he exists. By looking at everything that he's made, everyone in this room, everyone in this room knows, and everyone that's ever existed, in the depths of who they are, knows that there's a God, knows that he exists, knows that he's even knows that he's worthy of honor and glory and worship. Which means that the real question you're asking this morning is not, is there a God or is there not a God? Really, the real question you're asking is, do I want there to be a God? Or do I not? So beginning with that kind of bold, sweeping assertion, it begins to describe the root issue. In other words, why does the living room look like this? Why on earth? If I'm simply trying to stop my kids from burning the TV, rather than beginning to ask the question, maybe in later reflection, I might be a little upset at the moment, but in later reflection, beginning to ask the question, what on earth, why on earth would my kids throw the TV on the ground? It's a good TV. It has a good picture. Why would they throw it on the ground? And the root that comes out of this universal knowledge of God, this reality that everyone knows he exists, is the universal problem. The root of the problem is this. We have refused to honor him and give thanks to him. This is the Bible's description of the problem with the universe. You have refused to honor him and to give thanks to him. Giving thanks, we've emphasized, and so this week I want to emphasize honor. What does it mean that we have refused to honor God? If there is a God who created everything, then to honor him is not merely to acknowledge kind of on a superficial level that he's created the world. It means to submit to him in all things. It means that we receive from him all things. It means that we understand that the world is dictated by him, that he possesses all glory, yes, and all honor, yes, and all authority. That we are subject to him. Our bodies are subject to him. Our sexualities are subject to him. Our ways and approach to food is subject to him. Our approach to money is subject to him. The way that we speak to one another is subject to him. And get this, the way that we think about the world and think about our neighbor, even what we desire and what we feel is subject to him. And rather than honoring him by seeing to it that all of those things are subject to him, we rebel against him in all those things, seeking our own independence. This is the Bible's description of the human problem. It is not behavioral. It is a universal disposition that runs counter to the authority of God, the beauty of God, the grace of God. It is a declaration of independence against the rule of God over all things. And the result of that, Paul says, is that our minds become futile. Our thinking becomes futile, or as he says in our text, debased. And our desires, what we long for, what we lust after, what we desire and are passionate about, becomes dark. Spent almost all of last week talking about the relationship between why Paul would use the particular illustration of homosexuality and the darkening of desires. I want to focus this week on the futility of our thinking, the debasing of our way of thinking. Paul says that as we refuse to acknowledge God, as we refuse to honor God, as we refuse to give thanks to God, that the functional result of that in our lives, the functional result of that in our society, is that the very foundation of rational thinking, the very foundational of clear thinking, of useful thinking, is actually removed. We become incapable of clear thinking. We become incapable of real rational thought. In other words, our thinking becomes rooted in thin air, ungrounded to anything, untethered to anything that can make it real. We begin to think up our own understandings of how the world ought to be or how the world might be. We begin to think of our own reasons for why there are problems. We begin to think of our own solutions to those problems. And those solutions, those diagnoses of problems, our whole approach to rationality is untethered to anything real. It's simply our minds become spinning out of gear engines, untethered to anything real. What he describes is a universe shaped by thinking that is untethered to reality as it actually is. And then Paul describes in this text three exchanges that are the result of dark desires and futile thinking. And they line up strikingly. So first, three exchanges. You'll see in verse 23, look at it. They, becoming fools while thinking they're wise or claiming to be wise, they exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. So rather than worshiping, delighting in, serving the God who is infinitely beautiful and glorious and worthy of all worship, rather than serving him, we begin to worship created things. And not just created things, images of created things, poor images of created things. And you see this manifestly in pagan idolatry, but you actually see it not just in pagan idolatry. He's not just describing some particular cult practice in Rome in the first century. He's actually describing the nature and the prior disposition of all of humanity. We tend to chase after, to worship, to give our lives to, not God, not the glorious, good, honorable God, but things that are created. Things that are reflections of things that are created. In other words, lesser things. Oftentimes, good things. But good things that become ultimate things and therefore become slave masters to us. Things like prestige and honor. Things like success. Things like approval and being liked or being thought smart or brilliant. But maybe being thought culturally savvy, being well-liked. These created things become ultimate things, become enslaving things. Things that our desires then serve, things that our thinking then serves. And so we exchange what we were made to worship, what we were made to serve, what we were made to delight in, and namely the beauty, the word glory there, it's just, it's a fancy religious word for beauty, weighty beauty. We exchange the weighty beauty of the immortal God, the God who lives and has lived forever and ever and ever and ever, the one who's worthy of all worship. We exchange that for small created things, worshiping them and becoming enslaved to them. First exchange. Second exchange, you see in verse 25. Read it. They exchanged and served, they exchanged the truth about God for a lie. So not only have we exchanged the beauty of God, we've also exchanged the truth about God. Rather than believing true things about the nature and character of God, rather than believing true things about God's essence and his character and his sovereignty and his authority, we exchange that truth for lies about God. And he goes on to describe the result of that. And the result is we no longer worship the creator, but now we worship the creature, as he's already explained in his first exchange. And we serve created things rather than serving the one who is our creator. And the third exchange, and I'll say this is before I begin. Last week we spent an extended period of time in 24 to 27, particularly talking about homosexuality. And one of the questions that comes up, and I think is a very important question, is why does Paul emphasize, particularly in this text, the problem of homosexuality so centrally? And one of the things that I said last week, and I want to say to you again, particularly if you're in this room and you struggle with homosexuality or you would identify as homosexual, is that our culture has played a game on you in which your identity now is connected to your sexual desires. In other words, you are this. And I would just say to you that the Bible commends to you an understanding of yourself that is not determined by your sexuality. You are first and foremost, all of us, males and females, men and women, made in the image of God, made to reflect the image of God, held accountable to reflecting the image of God, beloved by God. That is who you are. Your sexual desires, whether gay or straight, are subsequent to that foundational definition of our identity. But one of the questions that's come up is why is this so central? It is very apparently central to Paul's argument in chapter 1 of Romans. And one of the reasons I think it's so central, in addition to the things that we talked about last week, is that he sees demonstrated for us not only a perfect illustration of the darkening of desires, which is a central result of us refusing to worship God, but also he sees in it that a demonstration of an exchanging, of turning away from the creator to worship the creature, which is the point that he makes just a few verses before that. And here's how so. Throughout Scripture, and particularly in Genesis 1 and 2, the reflection of, the picture of what the image of God is in the world is uniquely characterized, uniquely seen in the covenantal joining of a man and a woman in marriage. Their sexual union uniquely puts on display in the world what God is like. It is a reflection of the image of God. So you recall in Genesis chapter 1, it says, male and female, he made them. As an explanation of what does it mean that he's made us in the image of God. So Paul here says that there is an exchange. Women and men exchanging the image of God in covenantal union between a man and a woman, exchanging that demonstration of the image of God to worship rather a reflection of themselves in homosexuality. In other words, the kind of exchange that he's explained or kind of asserted previously in the chapter now lands in a very tangible way in his picture of what homosexuality is at its essence. It's a turning away from the image of God in male plus female, turning away from that picture of, that celebration of the image of God in that difference, to worship rather something that is a reflection of who you are rather than someone who is in essence different. And this is the trunk of the tree. First, a refusal to acknowledge God, a refusal to honor God, a refusal to worship God, which results in futile thinking, which results in dark desires. And those dark desires and futile thinking is demonstrated as we over and over again exchange the glory of God, the beauty of God, the wisdom of God, the truth of God for lies, for lesser things. As our worship and our delights turn away from the God we were made to see and know and worship and serve and find life in, to worship images around us of created things, and ultimately to turn in on itself and to worship ourselves. That's the trunk of the tree. And what's the result? What's the fruit that begins to grow on the branches of that tree? How does that then begin to spin up and describe and bear fruit? Not again just in our lives individually, but in our society. What does that look like? How does it play itself out? So I want to say to you that as Paul begins to describe here in very, very thick language, the place that we find ourselves in as human beings. And what he's simply pointing to is something that everyone in the first century, everyone that he's writing to, and frankly, I think all of us would recognize as he begins to describe the fruit on this tree, all of us would go, okay. And so his argument has been to start from foundations, to argue from things that we're going to have trouble discerning on our own, out to things that everyone sitting in the room as he's arguing would go, oh, okay, that. And then he's working backwards to say that where did all of this stuff come from that everyone's nodding at? In other words, everyone sees the evidence of the things that he's describing here. He's argued from the back saying, hey, here's where all of that stuff that we all recognize as a problem has come from. I was reminded this week of a quote from G.K. Chesterton that's one of my favorite quotes of all time, and I'm just going to take that excuse to read it. Okay? Because anytime you need an excuse to read Chesterton, use it. Modern masters of science are much impressed with the need of beginning all inquiry with a fact. The ancient masters of religion were quite equally impressed with that necessity. They began with the fact of sin, a fact as practical as potatoes. That's why we like Chesterton. Whether or no man could be washed in miraculous waters, there was no doubt at any rate that he wanted washing. But certain religious leaders in London, not mere materialists, have begun in our day not to deny the highly disputable water, but to deny the indisputable dirt. Certain new theologians dispute original sin, which is the only part of Christian theology which can really be proved. The strongest saints and the strongest skeptics alike took positive evil as the starting point of their argument. If it be true, as it certainly is, that a man can feel exquisite happiness in skinning a cat. I'll be honest, that's why I wanted to read the quote. Exquisite happiness in skinning a cat, then the religious philosopher can only draw one of two deductions. He must either deny the existence of God, as all atheists do, or he must deny the present union between God and man, as all Christians do. The new theologians seem to think it a highly rationalistic solution to deny the cat. That inclination that Chesterton identifies, that in the past we've looked at the world, we've looked at a world much like the one Paul describes here in these next verses, and we've said one of two things. One, this represents the problem of evil, therefore there must be no God. If there's this much evil overrunning our world, then how can we give an account to a God who is truly good, who made that world? Christians, on the other hand, look at a world that is overrun with evil, and their response is to say something is fundamentally broken between God and man. In our day, a new attempt has been made to deny both of those things, to deny that actually the world is the way that Paul is describing. And if I'm honest, I think that's why chapters like chapter 1 of Romans rub us the wrong way. We don't like being confronted with the darkness that surrounds us and frankly fills us. We'd rather deny the existence of the dirt than recognize that the provision of washing. And so I want to encourage you to listen to Paul's words here as he describes in the most graphic terms imaginable our problem. Not someone else's, I would remind you of. Not merely your neighbor's problem or society's problem or some politician's problem, but our problem. If you're here and you're not a Christian, the temptation as you hear these texts would be simply to say, those Christians are always accusing other people. I beg you to take note of my use of the word our in the sentences that are previous to that one. First, I want you to look at the language that he uses starting in the section between 24 and 27 and then moving in to verses 28 and following. First, he describes it in terms of burning or being consumed by. This is a progressive term. It's a term of which it starts as a desire. He doesn't describe particularly sexual desire here, but I think it applies to everything else he's about to talk about in this chapter, as well as our sexuality. It begins as a desire you can't shake. It begins as an inclination that you can't shake. It begins with a kind of envy or malice or greed or jealousy, or begins with a sense of pride or self-importance or self-righteousness. It begins as just a small inkling. It's something that over time grows and grows and grows like a fire that is set in the woods and begins small, begins to grow and grow and grow until the entire forest is consumed by it, defined by it, determined by it, enslaved to it. They burned with passion and desire, consumed by passion and desire. These things become the determining reality of our lives, setting the course of every decision we make, every justifying thought we use. Second, I want you to notice the language that he uses, starting in verse 29. They are filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness. And then the next He says, and they are full of. This language of filling up and being full of. It is a description here of that we are vessels meant to be filled with the glory of God, meant to be filled with the honor of and gratitude towards God. But instead, we get filled up with malice. We get filled up with evil. We get filled up with unrighteousness. So that as you begin to prick us, as anxiety begins to hit us, as pain begins to move towards us, as difficulty, we begin to stumble over those things. The things that begin to spill out of us are not the nice presentation of the outer cup, but rather the inside of us begins to come out. And what comes out is malice. What comes out is evil. What comes out is a maliciousness. What comes out of us is gossip and envy and things that are corrupting at its very core, showing that we are not the thin veneer that we present to the world. But underneath all of it, it's this stuff, this oozing wound, just spilling out into our lives, corrupting our speech, our relationships, our work, our use of money, our homes, breaking things that were meant to be whole. And last, kind of the final language that he uses here, I think this is actually the main progression he's building. He says in verse 29, they are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful. Now we're not just slowly being consumed by these things. Now we're not just being filled up by these things. We actually are becoming these things. In other words, the progression that Paul is describing of how sin works its way out in us, that the way that sin works its way out in our society is that here's a burning desire that begins to grow, that soon begins to fill us up, soon to the point that we would say they are full of these things, that we are full of these things, until the point that we become those things. Here's a quote from C.S. Lewis in his famous book, The Great Divorce. Hell begins with a grumbling mood, always complaining, always blaming others, but you are still distinct from it. You may even criticize it in yourself and wish you could stop it, but there may come a day when you can no longer. Then there will be no you left to criticize the mood or even to enjoy it, but just the grumble itself going on forever like a machine. It's not a question of God sending us to hell. In each of us, there is something growing which will be hell unless it is nipped in the bud. This is precisely the nature of Paul's description in Romans chapter 1. In handing us over in his wrath to our unfounded thinking, to our dark desires, we begin to do things, as he says, we ought not to do. And those things begin to consume us. They begin to slowly eat away at the very fabric of who we are. They begin to fill us up until we are full of those things, overflowing with those things, until in the end they become the very essence of what we are. We are no longer merely grumbling. We are the grumble. We no longer have envy, we become envy. We no longer gossip, but are gossips and slanderers. This is the nature and the progression and the darkness of sin. This is why our world is marked by the presence of these things. Now, what do we make of the list itself? Commentators universally comment that as commentators tend to do, draw the observation of the point that here is no progression, steady progression. It is simply a kind of rhetorical, universal list of here's how this refusal to honor God begins to manifest itself throughout society and throughout our lives. And included in here is everything from murder to hating your parents. It included in here is everything from gossip to slander to envy to the kind of ambiguous word, evil and unrighteousness, or a refusal to acknowledge God's law. Here is those who hate God. Here are those who, in their hatred of God and in their foolishness, are boastful and haughty. Here are us, those of us who invent evil to do, who disobey their parents, maybe by throwing down their TVs, are foolish and faithless and heartless and ruthless. In other words, here Paul is not trying to lead us along a progression, but simply saying, these are the things that begin to consume us. These are the things that begin to fill us up. These are the things that when you begin to prick us, they begin to ooze. And in the end, under God's wrath, they are what we become. And then last, though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. It's one thing to say, hey, here's isolated practices of evil, or here's a person who's been consumed in an isolated way with their evil. But what he says is the propensity, the direction of sin, the direction of this rebellion against God, the direction of this refusal to acknowledge God, it is evangelistic. In other words, it is designed to, it is oriented to constantly spread. Not only do we do these things, not only do we practice these things, not only do we slowly become these things, we encourage others along this path towards death. We encourage others towards this unraveling of their very humanity, this transformative practices, these practices that are in rebellion against God begin to change our very essence, and then we encourage others to join us on this journey to destruction, to join us in rebellion against God, to join us in refusing to acknowledge God and worship God, and instead making our own way and making our own world and redefining the very essence of what it means to be human. No longer as image bearers of God, as gossips and slanderers and haters of God, envious, filled with malice and haughty and boastful. And then perhaps the hardest word in this whole chapter. Knowing those that do these things, that practice these things, deserve to die. And I want you to hear me. This isn't Brian Brown. This is Paul in the Scriptures speaking with the very authority of God. That those who do these things deserve death. This is the problem. Paul has painted for us a vivid and dare I say, devastating picture that I believe all of us are tempted to look away from. But God has given us Romans 1 for a reason. And it is not so that we might look away from it. Rather, we would be confronted with this reality. We are becoming those things. In God's wrath, in our refusal to worship God, we are becoming those things that deserve to die. And so how will that problem be solved? On the night that Jesus was betrayed, after giving thanks to the bread, he broke it. And he said, "This is my body broken for you." And he took the cup and he poured it. And after blessing the cup, he said, "Take, drink of it, all of you. This is the blood poured out for the forgiveness of your sins." Christ Christ has come and died in our place. As we become those who deserve to die, one came and died for us. He bore the penalty for all this sin. He bore the penalty for all this idolatry. He bore the penalty for all of our foolish, idiotic, suicidal exchanges. That we might be called clean and washed and beloved sons and daughters of God. Let's pray.